Today's show is brought to you in part by the first Grand 3 Pick'em Challenge. This is an absolutely free contest where one player will win $100,000 and you are eligible to win $5 million. What you need to do, not going to say it's easy, but is to pick the top four finishers in three upcoming big dirt races, starting with the Preakness next weekend, continuing with the California Crown in the fall, and culminating with the Pegasus early next year. Entries will be live next Wednesday after we get that Preakness draw. Also, if you're a horseman or horse owner, there are bonuses across those three cards as well for your horses. A $5 million one for dirt and $2.5 million for turf. For more information about the first Grand 3 and the first Grand 3 Pick'em, go to inthemoneypodcast.com/grand. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players podcast. This is our show that we are recording on Friday, May 10th for racing on the 11th. Peter Thomas Fornital back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again. And we're going to just start off right away bringing in one of the people we turn to when we want to talk about racing out at Hawthorne. We've had daily Hawthorne coverage over at inthemoneypodcast.com from our mutual buddy, Howard Kravitz. But today, to talk about these races, the late pick four specifically, as the turf season begins in Chicago, we bring in Jim Miller. Jim, how are things?
I'm good, Peter. I'll tell you, it's been awesome just seeing the support from everybody because handle's been up, field size has been up. Now I think with the start of the turf season, you're going to get even better racing. And I'll tell you, these cards are wide open. We're getting these horses back from Oaklawn Park, getting some horses in from Tampa. Our fairgrounds horses are here. So it's a good mix of racehorses, and I think it makes the racing even more competitive.
Definitely, and I'm glad you mentioned that. There's two reasons why when we looked at our calendar and chose which when do we want to place our Hawthorne segments for our deal that we chose this weekend. And one is, of course, the opening of the turf season, but the other is just the way the racing calendar flows, these horses coming in from all over. And that's one reason why I'm so happy that we have the additional written coverage as well as the fantastic work that you're doing over there on the simul feed and elsewhere covering these races, trying to give that institutional knowledge for people. You know, I'm sure you're paying attention to the trends of where these winners are coming from and as well as using the fundamentals of handicapping. That kind of information, that extra stuff you get from circuit experts like yourself, like Howard, that's just going to help horse players looking at your product from around the country, I would think.
Yeah, and it really does. And a lot of it's equating kind of where you're coming from and what that competition level was and how that equates over here with the shift to Hawthorne, because we've seen some horses that may have run up the track against some really tough company at Oaklawn Park that come over to Hawthorne and they have running lines that don't look that great, but all of a sudden they run a really good race. And it's just because of that company they were facing, because you see at Oaklawn Park with those massive purses, there's so many horses that'll just take that deep drop into claiming races, knowing that they can run for that big money and possibly get claimed, where other horsemen may run just in the spot where they figure they're going to be competitive. And maybe they get beat up a little bit in there, but then they shift over here and all of a sudden a horse that maybe should be, say, 5-2, 3-1, all of a sudden sneaking off at 6 or 7-1. And that's kind of the time that you have to pounce.
Definitely the kind of stuff we'll be paying attention to as we look at Hawthorne. I did want to ask you one more question before we dive into the form, and that has to do with your Hawthorne contest schedule. Yep. I always say what great opportunities these events are for horse players with the prizes being added as opposed to ones that the players have to play for. What do you guys have coming up in terms of your contests?
Well, the next contests that are really fun that you want to kind of put on your calendar are June 29th and 30th. These are called the Hawthorne contests, and one is actually a feeder into our Horse Players Invitational on the 30th. But the cool thing about our contests, there's no entry fee. It's a $500 bankroll. Keep what you make, but we allow any type of bet, any racetrack that you want. There's NHC seats, Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge seats, Keeneland contest seats. But that's the biggest thing about it is, people have different circuits that they may want to focus on that may not necessarily be Hawthorne, where they have their expertise. Well, we want to allow those people to go out there and play those circuits. So it is really a truly genuine handicapping contest, management of a bankroll. And again, no entry fee. That's so important. You can get in with just your bankroll, but these are on June 29th and June 30th. And June 30th is going to be the Horse Players Invitational, which we show live on our YouTube channel as well. So it's a lot of fun, but all the details are on the website at HawthorneRaceCourse.com.
That's so fun. And that Invitational, that's a neat product you guys have done. Folks can check out the old versions on your YouTube channel. I'm excited to see how you do it again. You, like me, are a big believer that, you know, the way we cover these contests is also something that can really lead to more growth in the space. And you guys have done a terrific job just over the years putting on these contests. So circle those dates, get to Chicago, and look to play at the end of June. All the details on the website. Now let's talk about some racing, my friend. We'll start off with race number 5 on this Saturday, May 11th. We've got a field of 8 going postward, these fillies and mares, $4,000 claimers going the flying 5.5 on the dirt at Hawthorne. My eye was drawn to the runner on the outside, the 7-year-old mare, Cookin' Roses, who I thought had a chance to be the main speed, has 2 starts at the meet, is in good form. Do you think she's one of the ones to beat there? And who do you like in the 5th?
I think she potentially has a shot. The whole key to the race for Cookin' Roses is really the 3-horse Play 20, who's the other one who could possibly go out there and show some speed. So if those two hook up, the 2 horses that I actually looked to in this spot were the 4 Aunt Stella and the 5 Essential Bella, only for the running style. I don't think they're going to be too far off the pace. I do think they are going to be able to come running at him late, but it is going to kind of come down just to pace, because Aunt Stella in that last out was left to chase Play 20 the whole way around. When Play 20 is on the lead, she gets brave. When Cookin' Roses is on the lead, she gets brave. The problem is if those two hook up, may set things up for someone to come from a little bit out of it. So for me, I'm actually going to use the 4 Aunt Stella and the 5 Essential Bella in race number 5.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was thinking being the outside drawn of those speeds could be maybe a little edge for Cookin' Roses. But yeah, Play 20 is not going to give an inch down there looking at those pace figures a little bit more closely. So yeah, I'll probably try to back up a little bit with a closer in a bet like the pick 4, but I will still have some Cookin' Roses on the tickets, just guessing she might be able to be the best speed. Let's proceed to race number 6, where we've got Nickel Claimers going 1/16 on the dirt. Solid looking field of 8. Big favorite here on the morning line in the form of,
Eyes on deck?
How do you say that one?
Eyes on deck.
Eyes. Oh, of course. Eyes on deck. How'd I miss that one? Are you with or against in this spot?
I have to be against, only for the fact that she's won for 26 lifetime. I mean, if you want to toss her on the ticket, I'm not going to fault you for the fact that she's got 12 times finishing second or third. She just always seems, or he always seems, excuse me, to have that race where he comes running and just comes up short. But this is a race that doesn't have a whole lot of pace in it. So the 2 horses I looked to were 2 horses that I thought could show a little bit more speed. One of them being the 1, Palhaco, and the other, the 4, Hawaiian Hideaway. And Hawaiian Hideaway, really solid in that maiden score, 2 starts back. And in that last out, I don't know if they really liked the inside in that spot, because the horse didn't necessarily get the trip that they wanted, and he was kind of going after a little bit quicker pace. But that pace was actually set by Palhaco back in that April 20th race. And in that spot, he hung in there rather gamely into the lane. Well, in this race, Peter, I don't think he's going to have to go 47-4 and 1/12 and change to 3/4. I think he can back it down, maybe even a full second. And if that's the case, I could see Palhaco and Hawaiian Hideaway running 1/2 the whole way around, and Eyes on Deck again, just kind of running in for a spot underneath. But man, when you're looking at a short price favorite who's won for 26 lifetime, you kind of take that shot. If they're going to beat you, they beat you. And I'm going to take that shot here and see if I can defeat Eyes on Deck.
That was my inclination as well. And Hawaiian Hideaway was the one I wanted out of that common race. And you know, obviously did end up losing to the 4 and the 2 that day. But I was just thinking could get the best of the trips potentially this time around. And I like your idea maybe of the 2 speed number with him and Palhaco. So that's probably the way that I'm going to approach that. I'll use mine and I'll cheat off of your notes and throw in Palhaco, the 1 runner as well. Call it 4-1-1-4 for me in race number 6. And we're very much aligned in there and trying to beat that favorite, who I agree just has that tendency, like some horses do. They get there, they get right in the hunt, they think they've done enough. They're pack animals at the end of the day. Can't blame the horse, really, but not one I necessarily need on the tickets at a short price. We tease that this is the start of the turf season. This is the race where it will begin. Race number 7 for these maiden special weights going the flying. This is the proper flying 5 on the turf. First and foremost, we'll make you put your weatherman hat on. Yep. Will we stay on the turf for this race, do you think?
Man, I'm hoping. Like I said, with only one race on the turf on this card and it being a sprint, there's definitely the potential to stay on. It's later in the day. It's going to be sunny out this weekend. There's one small chance of a storm Friday night to Saturday morning. If that misses us, it's definitely going to benefit the chances of staying on the grass. But I'll tell you, turf or dirt, this is a really good race. But this is such a tough, tough race if it does stay on the grass.
If it does, I was looking at Ravenstown. Looks clear on the Timeform US pace projector. Maybe a horse that has the speed and has... It's not a pedigree that screams turf to me, but at least on the Timeform US algorithm, pretty equally rated on dirt and turf and synthetic. I was interested in maybe Ravenstown in this spot. What do you think is going to happen with him and the rest of these?
So he's one that's definitely going to be on my ticket. And in these turf sprints at Hawthorne, it is. It's a long stretch. It's tighter turns. It does tend to favor the outside. You have the potential to get shuffled back along the inside if you don't get away from the gate really well. So Ravenstown will definitely be on my ticket. A couple others that I'm going to use in here at prices. One of them being the 8, Midterm. Midterm was the horse that ran behind Ravenstown in their last out. And this horse was lugging in a little bit in the lane and kind of struggled a little bit to switch leads. But once the horse did, I thought he ran on rather nicely late. I think he could step up if you're looking at a price. And the other one, and we mentioned this earlier, these horses coming from Oaklawn Park over to Hawthorne, that could be factors. How about the 3, Red Rizzler? This one from the barn of Cody Rosine. Got away slowly in that debut. Ended up finishing last out of that field of 6. But again, a little bit tougher bunch. Now you're coming over here to Hawthorne, and this is a horse that got in and got a really good work over the main track, 47-3 for the half. He's going to be a price, and I don't think he has to show that speed, so the inside draw may not hurt him as much. So I'll use Ravenstown and then a couple of prices underneath and see if we can cash a little bit bigger on the late pick 4 in this race.
In terms of ranking those selections, would you put the 10 on top, or do you want to try to act more actively catch a price?
I'm going to try to put the 8 Midterm on top over Ravenstown and Red Rizzler. Just again, I think you're going to get every bit of that 10-1 on Midterm. Some of it has to do with the fact of the racehorse, but other of it has to do with some of the trainers in this race, because you get a Chris Block, you get Louis Roussel, you get Larry Ravelli with 2 in this spot. Because of that, some of these other horses tend to get overlooked at the windows, and I think Midterm could be one of those.
We close out the Saturday card with race number 8, Nickel Claimers, going 6 furlongs and a notably big field here, 11 runners to close things out, a race that looks to have plenty of pace signed on. What do you think? Are you going to take something from nearer the lead here anyway, or are you going to look for something to come from off the pack?
Well, one thing that's going to be very big about this race is the outside horse to Archer is going to scratch out of this spot for a spot on Sunday. That's important for the fact that the Archer could have shown some of the speed in this race, so... Yep. I am actually going to look up front now, and 2 of the horses I'm going to use are the 9 Hurt So Bad and the 8 Pinballer, because I think they have the potential even to go 1-2 the whole way around. I think Hurt So Bad is a little bit faster early on. I think Pinball has the potential to chase. So those are 2 horses that could be in the mix, both at prices. And then the other one to look at, Peter, again, it's one of those that was racing against Tougher at Oaklawn with really bad running lines, but could get in the mix, is the 3, Violent Gigi. This is a horse that's going to find it so much easier here. But because those running lines look so, so poor, this is a horse that you might be able to catch a little bit of a price. So it'll be the 9 over the 8-3 for me in the finale.
I'll throw one other out there for you. And this is another one of these, you know, it'd be interesting to see how the turfway form ends up translating. But Carl G, I thought, was a little bit interesting in this spot. Horse did seem to improve markedly for the synthetic surface in terms of the recent form. But if those numbers could be replicated on the dirt and they do end up going too fast, I mean, the 11 coming out definitely lessens the pace battle, but there's still plenty of speed in this spot. I was wondering if Carl G couldn't grind up there and maybe get a piece or potentially more at 10-1 on the morning line. Can you see that one if you squint for?
Oh, definitely. And here's the thing about it. You pick up leading rider Orlando Mojica for a barn that is down at FanDuel Racing, where they are racing live this weekend as well, too. Harry Lynch, instead of choosing to stay there and race, is going to come up here for this spot instead. So that's kind of a telling sign, too. So he might think he might have the right setup and the right spot also. So it wouldn't surprise me by any means.
old warrior, that seven-year-old gelding too. Another one who, you know, and I think it's partially due to the running style, has settled for plenty of thirds, but does have six wins in the 50 starts. Kind of a cool horse, one to root for regardless, but one that I'll definitely be working onto my tickets, and I'll certainly be listening to you. And also I'll take a look at Howard's work over at InTheMoneyPodcast.com. And with your expert help, even as somebody who, you know, is relatively new to playing Hawthorne on the regular, I feel like I'm able to hang in there and compete. Appreciate you very much, my friend, and we'll have you back on real soon.
I can't wait. I'll tell you, we're getting into the start of the stakes season pretty soon, too. And like I said, turf racing definitely going to be something that boosts up those fields.
Very happy to bring in my next guest, Jay Privman, Hall of Famer. Jay Privman, whose work we've all read and admired for years in the pages of Daily Racing Form, seen his work on network TV. And Jay, is it safe to say after your adventures on social media yesterday that you're not going to be attending the Taylor Swift, Kelce wedding coming up imminently?
No, I'm hoping I'll get an invite. No, I have no animosity towards Jason Kelce for our celebrated, I guess it was celebrated or back and forth yesterday. I thought his responses were acknowledged, you know, what I was trying to get at. I think a lot of people on Twitter didn't quite understand what I was trying to get at. And that's, I think, why you reached out to me. I admire the guy. I mean, the guy was a Hall of Fame football player. He's now going on in the media. He and his brother, to me, look like they'd be cool guys to hang with. I just thought what he did yesterday was out of bounds, and I wanted to kind of, in a sort of mocking way, show him why I thought it was out of bounds. And thank you for putting up on the screen here. This is the thing I really want to illustrate. So his initial tweet regarding Secretariat, I thought was inappropriate because it just has no basis in fact. And so my way of sort of trying to show him, hey, look, don't put out something that has no basis in fact, it's really an unfair thing to do, was to take the template of what he wrote and overlay with the exact same words my stuff, but, you know, putting it on him. Like, here's something that somebody could say about you that has absolutely no basis in fact. So hopefully this will resonate with you. And that was why, as you can see, I've kind of used the exact same language he did with, you know, but just putting it on him as a, where he puts it on Secretariat. So that was the point of it. I thought, oh, this is kind of a fun, clever way to get a point across about media responsibility for somebody who's now in the media and is, I think, going to end up having a pretty long and career in media. He's, from all indications, he's going to have, you know, a lot of work coming this fall. He's already got the podcast, obviously, with his brother. But it seemed like he took it well from the response I got from him. But, and there were a lot of people on Twitter, Pete, who seemed to completely understand where I was going with this. But as often happens in social media, there were plenty who did not want to take the time to like look at it and sit with it. And we're like, how could you be such a callous, awful person and say he's brain damaged? Which is clearly, if you look at what's here, not what I was doing.
For those that didn't see the Kelce, original Kelce tweet, just going to put this out there. You know who else has enlarged hearts? People who take copious amounts of steroids. I'll admit, I don't know whether Secretariat was on steroids or not. It's impossible to know because in 1973, when Secretariat won the Triple Crown, there was not steroid testing, etc. Jay's tweet mimicking the language, just to put this out there. You know who else makes unsubstantiated claims not backed up by facts? People suffering from CTE. I admit, I don't know whether Jason Kelce suffers from CTE, but it's impossible to know. I mean, it was pretty clear. The parody, I think, was pretty clear. And it was interesting, though, that Jason came back not getting angry, but actually, interestingly, acknowledging the very possibility you were joking about. I mean, it was a wild and interesting exchange for sure. And the place I want to start with this, you know, what is a popular person on Twitter's responsibility to journalistic ethos? Is Twitter more people standing around at some sort of weird water cooler that you know the whole world can be invited to, Or is it a place where journalistic standards are required in your view? I just wanted to ask you that general question as a starting point.
I think it can be both. I think it just depends on the topic and what you're talking about. If you're just an opinion, if you're just offering an opinion, like, I think the Eagles are better than the Chiefs. Okay, that's an opinion. But what he put out there to me crossed the line of an unsubstantiated claim. There's no basis in fact for what he did. And I also, one of the reasons I responded to it is because he's now a member of the media. And I think to your point, Pete, when you are a member of the media, you have a responsibility to be accurate and fair. And I thought what he did was neither of those. It was neither accurate nor fair. And I wanted to, what I was hoping to do what I was hoping was a clever way, point out to him, look how unfair this is. I'm saying something that is completely out of bounds and over the top regarding you. Get it? You know, because right. What you did is the equivalent of that. And I think based on his response, he got that. Others, however, appeared not to.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I like how you frame that, especially making that point about him being held to a different standard, not just because of his popularity, but because this is now his profession. So this is something that actually, you know, could be helpful to him. And I think rather than looking to dunk on him, it did almost feel like you were pointing something out that would actually be useful in his career. I mean, is it fair to say that that was a piece of your motivation there?
Absolutely. I was just hoping it would resonate with him of like, oh, okay, I see what he's getting at here. You know, maybe I went a little too far. And I mean, I thought he took it well. You saw some of the responses he had, not only to myself, but to other people saying, yeah, you know, maybe I went too far. Hopefully it's a learning lesson. You know, I don't want anybody to think that I'm wishing or hoping that he has anything bad going on. I don't think he has anything bad going on. I have no proof he has anything yet bad going on. And there was nothing in that tweet that was, in my mind, saying that. It was just, I wanted to use the template of what he had regarding Secretariat to point out, boy, look how unfair it would be for somebody to say something about you that has absolutely no basis in fact.
You're a historian of the game. I love your book about the Breeders' Cup. I know Derby history inside and out, having covered the whole Triple Crown for Daily Racing Form for many, many moons. I mean, you've said it already that it has no basis in fact, but from what you know of history and steroids and horses at the time, I mean, is this even something that there's any work on? Is there any, what do we know about what was going on back then? Just sort of out of curiosity as much as anything else.
I don't know writ large regarding the sport then. What I do know, though, and that something that is factually known, is that there was an autopsy done on Secretariat afterwards. There was published data by the veterinarian who did the autopsy, and he said that it was just an enlarged heart, but a naturally enlarged heart, and there was nothing untoward regarding the pathology. I mean, you can look all that up. In fact, Bill Knack wrote about it. And Bill Knack, who was the greatest chronicler of Secretariat, wrote about it when it happened that, you know, Secretariat had a large heart, but it was, everything was normal in terms of its proportions. It was just a large heart. And that probably was what gave him the lung capacity and the endurance to do what he did. But there was zero evidence that anything untoward had gone on with the horse. And I think to make, you know, an unsubstantiated claim about that 50 years on kind of impugns the integrity of the people who were associated with the horse back then, all of whom are gone and can't defend themselves. So that's another aspect of this that I just think is grossly unfair to even bring it up.
Yeah, I think that is a very fair comment. The Knack book is one of the greats. I must admit that I did have the thought, you know, as much as I miss Bill, who I got the chance to meet a couple of times, and his writing, I did have the thought, perhaps it's just as well he didn't live to have to deal with this particular comment. Some of why this blew up the way it did, doubtless, you know, I've got my Slough shirt on. some of this blew up though because of it even, you know, the pantheon that they're in as Triple Crown winners. The Secretariat holds a very special place in people's hearts, and I think that's got to be some reason why it became the firestorm that it did. That it was basically like Mr. Kelce going into church and dropping his pants because of the special place Secretariat holds in so many of our hearts. Do you think that's a fair comment?
Probably. I mean, you'd have to ask other people, you know, why they responded the way they did. I can only speak for myself, and I just outlined the reasons I responded the way I did. It, you know, regarding Secretariat, though, I will tell you one anecdote. You know, when he was winning the Triple Crown, I was a teenager. I was only 13 years old then. And, you know, being an unsophisticated fan at the time, I hated Secretariat back then because he was beating up on my favorite horse back then, which was Sham. And it wasn't until later when I came to appreciate what Secretariat was and had accomplished. But my, you know, teenage 13-year-old person at that time just was, you know, angry that Secretariat was beating my favorite horse.
I'll show you where I stand on the subject. This was a Father's Day gift from last year. We've got the gold briar of Secretariat. So maybe that's my bias coming through with that last observation. While I have you, I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't talk about industry stuff as well as we sometimes do. Quite specifically, the performance of the stewards on Kentucky Derby Day. And rather than me opine on this, I'll just ask you this question. What grade would you give the stewards' performance in this year's Kentucky Derby?
F. because it was a failure, you know, which is what F stands for when you're grading things. There's just no excuse not to post the inquiry sign, let alone take down Sierra Leone for what he did in the stretch run with Forever Young. But, you know, it starts with just putting up the inquiry sign. Show people, yes, we saw it, we're looking at it, we know that there's millions bet on this race, there's millions watching this race, and yes, we saw it, we're going to let you know we're going to take a look at it. So they did none of that, obviously. They didn't post the inquiry sign. They claimed 42 hours later in a statement put out by the Racing Commission that they had reviewed the race, but that's not the same thing as an in-time putting up the inquiry sign. I thought Frank Angst in the Blood Horse wrote an on-point editorial regarding that specific issue. He was dead on it. So that, to me, Pete, was the first failure. And then, you know, there was an incredible amount of money that was impacted by their lack of action. I think any reasonable person who looks at that stretch run would come to the conclusion that Sierra Leone cost Forever Young second place. And if you reverse those positions, it changes the exacta for sure. It changes the order of the trifecta and superfecta, et cetera. If you've got a place bet on Forever Young, it changes that as well. So there's all kinds of things that were impacted by their lack of action. So I thought they failed in terms of posting the inquiry sign. And they also failed, of course, in not taking action that I think was appropriate in that specific instance regarding that stretch run.
Little to add, just incredibly well put. And, you know, for me, it led to frustration, not so much from a gambling point of view, but just as a racing fan point of view. I feel like, Jay, I mean, how many of these big days have we had to have conversations like this afterwards? What hope or help is there in terms of racing being able to get out of its own way and let just the stars, and boy, there were stars and excitement on Derby Day, and gosh, I'll be honest, I love this renovation. I was a very positive experience, but I still felt, and this is not me talking through my pocket because it didn't matter in that regard, but I still felt at the end of the day like we didn't show ourselves in the best light as a sport again. What, if any, solutions are there to this and other things along these lines that we've talked about on podcasts after big days so often the last several years?
So I'll address that in a quick second. I do want to say, Pete, that, you know, one of the unfortunate things about what you just brought up and what you and I are talking about is that it's taken away from an incredible historical achievement last weekend by trainer Kenny McPeak and jockey Brian Hernandez Jr. to win both the Oaks and the Derby. The first time a jockey had done it in, I think, 15 years. The first time a trainer had done it in almost 75 years. And it had been almost the exact same timeline for a trainer and jockey together to win both races. Those are incredible achievements. And unfortunately, the aftermath of the Derby in terms of the stewards' lack of action, I think, you know, took away a little bit from that. And I hope we can sort of start, as we now are going to turn the page and head on towards the Preakness, I hope we can really focus in on, hey, can Mystic Dan do it again and stay alive for a Triple Crown bid, and focus on the accomplishments of Kenny McPeak and Brian Hernandez. Now, to your question, you know, what can we do? I don't know. Honestly, Pete, I think the officiating in this country is horrendous. You know, we saw a phantom takedown at Naira earlier this year in a stake race. We've seen it twice now in the last few years in the Derby where the stewards needed, in the case of Maximum Security, it had to be jockeys filing a claim for them to look at, you know, what everybody saw was an obvious incident that needed at least to be reviewed, you know, let alone take action on it. And they didn't take action this past Saturday owing to the situation. I think if the Japanese rider had claimed fouled, then, you know, then they'd have looked at it. But it should not be on the jockeys to claim foul. You know, they're coming back to the same locker room as their other riders. The stewards are above all that, literally and figuratively. They're the ones who need to initiate these things and not passively sit back, especially when it's something that's so obvious that we all saw in both the Maximum Security Derby and this one the other day. And then, you know, speaking larger about issues on big days with racing officials, you know, there was the whole Modern Games fiasco at Del Mar and the Breeders' Cup a few years ago, too. So we have these big days and officials who just seem incapable or unwilling or unable to do their job properly. And I'd really like to see just a better quality of officiating and a better understanding of communicating with the public that, yes, we're doing our job. And that was a major failure on Derby Day last weekend.
Just brainstorming here, but is this something that you could possibly see an organization like HISA trying to get involved in? I mean, I think about, and gosh, they still make mistakes too, but I think about the way that MLB handles their replays now with everything going to a central office where you could have your absolute best people potentially with the right camera setup, looking at these things, making decisions, trying to take it out of the hands of some of these smaller committees. Is there any mechanism for that to happen anytime ever in horse racing?
Well, I think we've already got accreditation that goes on regarding the stewards nationally. And so there is that already. Maybe it needs to go to HISA as well. I just would like to see the racing commissions and the stewards held to more accountability and for people to have, you know, trainers get dinged and jockeys get dinged for when they do something wrong. I rarely see that happen with stewards. Now, we've seen in the case of in New York, you know, two of the three organizations that put stewards in the booth have made changes in the last year. It seems that there was an acknowledgement that things needed to change there. Regretfully, you know, to this point, the steward who seems to be the one who rules the roost there and seems to be the one who causes most of the problems, at least from what we can tell from afar, is still in position there. And, you know, until situations like that change and until stewards in Kentucky now twice with the same people in recent years just swallowing the whistle, you know, that needs to change. And if HISA needs to come in and add that to their list of things to do, maybe that would help. I would just like to see a better quality of officiating, and I hope we can get to it because it's not up to standard now. It's just not. You watch races every day in this country, and you can't be, I think, confident that the competency of stewards nationwide is on the level of when, you know, Keen Dangerfield and Pete Pedersen ruled the roost. There are very good stewards in many places, but on the whole, I think we have a problem in this country with the quality of officiating.
Let's end on a different note, on a more optimistic looking forward note. You posed the question before that what we should be talking about is, you know, can Mystic Dan keep this run going? What's your gut? How serious of a contender is he in the Preakness Stakes? Can he hold off Muth and all the rest?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously Muth beat him in the Arkansas Derby, and Mystic Dan's going to be coming back in 2 weeks. So that on paper would seem to favor Muth, but I think Mystic Dan has been overlooked quite a bit through his career. He's run big figures a couple of times now. He makes good trips. Brian Hernandez gives him good trips. You know, the mile and 3/16 of the Preakness should be absolutely fine for him. So I would certainly not discount his chances. I think he's a quality colt, and I'm looking forward to seeing how he performs as he goes forward in the Preakness.
It's going to be fun to check it out. Jay, we appreciate you this time. And every time you come on these airwaves, we'll see. Maybe you'll get that invitation to the wedding yet. In any case, we'll be talking soon.
Regardless, Pete, you know, if anybody has a problem with what I did, just know I'm going to shake it off.
Very nice. I see what you did there. Next up, special little segment looking back at the Kentucky Derby. We've done plenty of this on the early week show and on our YouTube channel already, but this was a chance to talk about it with a guy who's really stuck into the trip handicapping aspect of things. He covered the Derby for us trip-wise over at In the Money Plus. He's actually going to be doing a full write-up for Plus of the Oaks and Derby trips. If you're a Plus member, you'll get that. One of the many reasons we want to keep folks hanging around who signed up to In the Money Plus for the Derby, because we're going to have a bunch of extra fun stuff like this all season long, as well as extra podcasts, one of which this guest will be doing with me for the carryover on Friday, if there's still time for you to listen to that. But the man I speak of is Justin Christine. Justin, how are you?
I'm great, Pete. Thanks. Yeah, what a, I think everybody got what they wanted with the Derby drama. It was quite a show.
It was a show, that's for sure. And I have to thank you personally. Honestly, look, I didn't use Mystic Dan a lot. As it turned out, I needed him. The only live ticket I would have had, I did do some, you know, I was a huge Team Fierceness guy, but I did sort of stick to my words and end up with a very tiny percentage of plays with Fierceness all the way out, where I think I probably would have left Mystic Dan out. I didn't put him on top, but I did have him second and third because of the trip note you wrote about him in the Arkansas Derby, which suggested that that race maybe wasn't as bad as it looked. You noted, you know, some of the difficulties he had in there. And I was, you know, so moved to say, you know what, this is a horse with a fig as high as anybody who's not named Fierceness. Got to leave him in at least underneath. Were you clever enough in your own bets to take your own advice and leave Mystic Dan in some combinations?
Well, first of all, thanks. That's kind of you to say that. I was in the same boat as you. I had him, you know, as a B and a couple pick threes, a couple doubles. I did have a trifecta with him and a couple other of my second tier horses on top. I didn't get the second and third correct. So, you know, I used him, but I wasn't clever enough to hook him up with any of the races before or after or with the second and third place finishers. So, it was a little bit off or not, but yeah, he had a wide trip against the slow pace in the Arkansas Derby, which I think muted his figure a little bit, you know, and if you believed in that 100, which I think a lot of people didn't because they thought the rail was gold on that day at Oaklawn, you know, I think a lot of people dismissed him for that reason.
Yeah, that was where I came from at first, but then as I started thinking about it more, like even if you take away 4 or 5 points from the bias-aided 101, if you're all of a sudden giving him an excuse for the second to last race, he's still figure-wise right there with Sierra Leone. Like, so why go crazy and chuck him out? Eric DeCoster also was a big defender of his. I mean, I even said, this is so embarrassing to admit, but I think I even said to Eric at one point after the Arkansas Derby, before I had read your trip analysis of that race, are you even sure Mystic Dan should be in the top 10? And he made the point, look, he ran that big race. He had a little excuse. You know, all credit to Eric for keeping him in the top 10 the whole time. So, you know, even though I still do believe the effort in the Southwest was a little bit flattered, but, you know, he wasn't far behind. And this wasn't with fierceness, no showing. It was not a Derby with horses that had run big speed figures. And, you know, there's even some suggestion from private figure makers and just the way the race looked on the wire that even the 100 on the Beiler scale is fast for this group. Time Form had it a little bit lower, and some private figure makers I've talked to had it even lower than that. So let me ask you, obviously, we're not going to ask you to go through your trips on the Derby and Oaks. Folks are going to have to sign up for In the Money Plus, inthemoneypodcast.com/plus to get that. But I'd love your take as a more trip-oriented player on the question we've been debating this week. Who, in your view, was best in the Kentucky Derby?
Forever Young. He made a mess at the start. He was in a tough spot. He checked early. He was wide. He made up a ton of ground. And then Sierra Leone was laying all over him in the stretch, you know,
yep,
several times. I can't help but think, you know, that prohibited him from stretching out even more, you know, in the final furlong or two. And, man, he showed a lot of courage and a lot of grit. And, you know, I can't help but think that he probably had one of the worst trips in the Derby, and yet to finish just the nose out of first place, my answer would be an emphatic Forever Young.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I take the idea that if Sierra Leone had just run straight in the stretch, he wins. But I don't want to give credit because of a self-inflicted wound. You know what I mean? He didn't run straight because that's a quirk of his, and he hurt obviously Forever Young in the process. I think that, so I don't, even though Jonathan made the Sierra Leone case, I'm not really buying that one. The case I would buy, if you cared to make it, just because I'm so tuned into figure dynamics, pace dynamics and things like that, is the idea that for Mystic Dan to have been as close to that fast pace as he was, and to see where all those other horses finished. And I know from reading your trip notes over the years that this is something you look at, that from a dynamics point of view, you could certainly make the case that Mystic Dan is an upgrade over what he did. And I wouldn't really want to argue with anybody who said he was best. But for me, you know, he just had so much luck that I'm willing to sort of just counterbalance a little bit of the dynamics and say, I'm going to upgrade that a little. I'm going to upgrade Forever Young a little bit more. What do you make of the argument that Mystic Dan was best because of the pace dynamics?
I thought he got the most beautiful trip you could ever ask for in the Kentucky Derby. He was alone on the rail for a good portion of the race.
Yes.
You know, like when horses get between other horses, that, you know, it's stressful for them. He
yes.
was just at a great rhythm, alone. And then, you know, all the credit to Brian Hernandez Jr. for squeezing into that spot when Track Phantom was too slow to close the door on him coming into the stretch. He squeezed through that hole, saved all the ground. You know, at first I was in the camp that he was best of speed. But when I watched it a whole bunch of times and just starting to think that those horses on the front end, Fierceness was a no-show. Track Phantom, I don't think was ever going to get the distance. Just Steel, I have no idea what that horse was doing on the pace. You know, and so the more I think about it, Epic Ride was up there. The more I think about it, you know, these horses that were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, were, you know, I didn't expect to, beside Fierceness, I didn't expect to finish in the Derby. And when Fierceness yeah. threw in the towel, you know, it just sort of opened the door for Mystic Dan, who sat this beautiful trip.
Great point. Hadn't thought about it like that, but that's a great point. That some of those horses finishing way back, yes, the pace was a factor, but the fact that they were non-stayers, non-show-ups was also a factor. And you're making me feel better about my decision here for the way that I've been framing this. I'll probably steal that. I'm going to encourage people to take a look at the work that Justin is doing for us over on the Plus side. We have him a lot on the free side as well. I'm going to be continuing to hear from him throughout the year. Any other thoughts from you quickly, you know, stuff that maybe you can't capture in the trip notes, but observations from Derby and Oaks Day?
Well, I guess maybe just two quick things. It, you know, if you're talking about the break in the Kentucky Derby and how important it is, look no further than Mystic Dan versus Door Knock. I mean, that was the tale of two breaks. Mystic Dan got off beautifully. Door Knock was just a little slow, tried to get hustled up into the race. And by that time, Miss McMahon had the rail and Dornock had to steady. And, yep. and basically his race, you know, his race, I mean, he had a lot of trouble in that race, but it all started there. And then, you know, this should come as no surprise to anybody, but the ride put on Catching Freedom by Pratt was just a clinic. I mean, he was in the right spot all the time. He was patient. He got around horses. He got back to the rail when he needed to. And you know, I mean, you have to have the horse in a race like that. But, man, did he put on a textbook ride.
As ever seems to be the case. You know, somebody gave me a hard time on YouTube for giving Brian Hernandez all the credit to getting through the hole. They said, what about, and they were saying it in a nice way. They're like, what about giving credit to the winner? What about Mystic Dan being game enough to listen to his rider and go through there? I think that's a fair point. Doesn't matter who the rider is. Some horses ain't going through there. Would you agree with that idea?
100%. And if you listen to Brian Hernandez on interviews, he constantly talked about how Mystic Dan gave him two and three moves throughout that race. And, you know, only really good horses can give you a second and a third move when you need it. And he was just so complimentary of the way Mystic Dan gave those to him when he needed them.
You made that point about the Tale of Two Trips with Track Phantom and Dornock. At the end of the day, you know, JK and I'm not trying to dunk on JK on the show, by the way, though I'm bringing up a couple of things where I think I'm right and he's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't mind the draw at all for Sierra Leone. I think, now look, Sierra Leone should have won anyway and kind of threw away the race logging. I feel comfortable saying that. But I do think that the draw, is it fair to say that the draw proved to be bad for him, given how far back he got and then ending up having to get in that one weird spot where he did have to check on the first turn? Do you think the draw ended up costing Sierra Leone a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's completely fair, because I think I just wrote in his trip note for the Derby, you know, he watched all those horses come down in front of him, and he had no choice but to be where he was, you know, on the front side and around that first turn. I mean, you know, if he draws a little further outside, maybe he stays in the clear. Maybe he gets to launch that move a little sooner. Maybe he's even a little closer than, you know, 18th when they turn up the backside. So I completely agree with that. That's a great point.
Yeah, I thought, you know, he would have been able to do a little bit better getting position going forward. But, of course, he was in a spot to win, and he, in my view, lugged it away. So it's not, you know, it's one of those things where I think at the end of the day, Sierra Leone, the gun was pointed squarely at his own hoof as opposed to the trip being the difference. But just interesting things for people who like to talk about trips, and you're one of them, Justin. So thank you for coming on for this brief appearance today. Folks should check out Justin's trips through the In the Money Podcast Plus platform, In the Money Plus, inthemoneypodcast.com/plus, the place to go for that. Justin, we're done for this segment, but stick around and we'll do the Plus segment next.
Always fun, Pete. Thanks.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I want to thank all of today's guests, as well as our founding partners over at 10 Strike Racing. Looking forward to getting a chance to hang out with them soon down at Pimlico. And also Therapeutic Horses of Saratoga. That's where Kim Weir's working now. To learn more about their mission, go to inthemoneypodcast.com/horses. Thanks most of all, though, to all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do, especially those of you who are signed up for our free email newsletter. Best way to keep track of all the content we got coming down the pike on the written side. Lots of free analysis over at the website, as well as the YouTube channel, and of course podcasts as well, and other links of interest. inthemoneypodcast.com/email. The show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.